This special series of the Information's 411 has been made possible in partnership with Brex. Later, we'll have a conversation with Brex's CEO, Enrique Dubugras. Stripe, Bolt, Ramp, Fast, Chime. These names are among the fastest growing companies providing financial services technologies. From payment software, to bank deposits, to one-click checkout services, to corporate card and work expenses software, to banking apps for consumers, fintech is having a big, big moment. Welcome to the Information's 411 and the fourth episode in our five-part series on the Information 50, our annual list of the most promising startups you probably haven't heard of, valued at less than $1 billion. Yes, the bull market we've seen during the pandemic and the IPO successes of stock trading app Robinhood and buy now, pay later provider Affirm set the private fintech market on fire in 2020. But the sector got twice as much VC funding this year as it did last year, an astonishing $87 billion so far. To make sense of the fintech frenzy, I talked to my colleague Kate Clark, who reported on this year's list, about her selections, valuations in the sector, and what's coming next. Then, she'll speak to Itai Damti, the Israeli CEO of our top fintech pick this year, Unit. And after that, she'll talk to Enrique Dubugras, CEO of corporate card startup Brex, another fast-growing fintech firm. But first, here's Kate. Kate, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So fintech had a massive year, the year of fintech. And as you've pointed out, $87 billion worth of venture capital went into fintech startups this year, double the rate of last year. How big of a surprise was that?
I would say it was less of a surprise than you might think. Looking back in 2020, it was also a similarly explosive year for fintech. And I think many of us who follow the space closely did expect to see those numbers rise in 2021. Maybe not as high as 87 billion, but certainly I do expect that that number will probably be surpassed once again in 2022.
And what is driving that? Certainly, we had a lot of impact from the kind of bull run in the stock market. A lot of people putting money to work in various ways, and certainly that boosted companies like Robinhood and its ilk. What else was leading this surge and made it so obvious that 2021 was going to be the year of fintech?
There are so many reasons, and I think all of them do tie back to the COVID-19 pandemic. You mentioned Robinhood, and I think that's a really great example that really reflects a lot of the new interest in fintech. That company did see a huge boom in users as retail investors really embraced stock trading amid the pandemic. Another really great example, I think, is Chime. They were able to see many, many new customers amid the pandemic as people became more comfortable with digital finance. You couldn't go visit your local branch during the darker months of the pandemic. And as a result, many folks, including elderly people and others, really embraced digital banking for the first time. But I really think that consumers' embrace of digital finance was a huge reason for the boom. I also think just at a really high level, there were so many new companies started during the pandemic, and many of those did choose to embrace fintech as it was already a very lucrative category, and it was already an area of interest for venture capitalists. So I don't think we were too surprised to see that that was one of the most embraced categories among founders and among venture capitalists sort of entering into 2022.
And you mentioned Chime, and certainly the banking sector is changing. There are lots of upstarts that appear to be causing the legacy companies to react and change. What else, what other categories were you particularly interested in coming into this year that led to your five selections for this year's TI50 list?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, we're talking about Chime and Robinhood, which are consumer companies, but this year, actually, I was much more interested and focused on those behind-the-scenes, sort of less sexy fintech companies, which you might call banking-as-a-service company, like Unit, which topped our list, or embedded finance, or even just fintech infrastructure, which are companies that make everything happen, but aren't necessarily, you know, having commercials on TV like Chime or putting their name on top of a basketball arena. But these companies were incredibly important this year because so many other companies that aren't in fintech wanted to have payments on their website or wanted to embrace fintech in some other way. And companies like Unit are allowing them to do that.
So let's talk about some of your selections. Obviously, you're going to be talking to the Unit CEO in just a few minutes. Tell us a little bit about that company and some others that are providing this kind of infrastructure.
Yeah, so Unit, as I mentioned, is a banking as a service platform. Its software lets companies embed financial services, such as payments and bank accounts, into their own products. The founders, Itai Damti and Duron Somech, previously launched a brokerage technology company called Leverate. So they have a lot of experience in the space.
What are some of the companies that they help that are incorporating financial services with the aid of these kinds of startups?
Yeah, I mean, there's a broad spectrum of companies that they're working with or could work with. Among some of their existing customers is the startup investment platform AngelList. And another one is the edtech startup Moss. But there are several others as well.
Another one I wanted to ask you about is Routable, which is bill paying software. If I recall, you had a bill paying related company in last year's list. And I'd love to know why bill paying continues to be such a active and exciting area in fintech startup land.
Look, there are a lot of small businesses that have to pay bills, and the existing technologies, the legacy technologies there, are just not suitable anymore. I think, you know, people don't want to Xerox or fax things or have to print things out. We're far past that. So I think you're going to continue to see a lot of companies that are targeting that demographic, as I said, because there's always going to be that need. So you mentioned last year's list, and I think you're referring to Melio Payments, which was our number one pick last year, and it's since performed very well. Similarly, we have another entry on this list in that category, and that's Routable. And I suspect that next year we'll have another one, and probably every year, because it's going to continue to be a market with a lot of demand.
And so with these two companies that we just called out, they're both valued at about $200 million post-money or a bit more. And I wanted to ask you about valuations. Was it difficult this year to find startups that had shown promise, but were valued at less than $1 billion?
I think that's a really good question. My answer is no. I don't think it was difficult to find companies with promise that were valued under $1 billion, but I can see why you would ask that, because in this market, really early stage companies and companies with, you know, frankly, very little to prove that they deserve such valuations are raising at, you know, valuations north of $1 billion or, you know, even higher. It's crazy. But I think if you are searching at the seed stage, which is primarily where I was looking, you will still find some really great companies that stand out that don't have inflated or overhyped valuations. Though I do think that it is going to become more challenging unless we see a correction in the market. I think it will become more challenging to find those companies that have more, I guess you could say, reasonable valuations for the stage that we're looking at when we do this list.
And for Unit and Routable, it looks like they're both founded by Israelis. Routable, which is bill paying software, was making me think of a company called Check, which was acquired by Intuit almost 7 years ago, I can't believe. That was also led by an Israeli. What is it with Israelis and fintech companies? Do you know?
No, I mean, I think Israel has clearly emerged as a fintech hub, as has New York. And there are a lot of factors which contribute to an area becoming sort of a central headquarters for different industries. But I think, yes, you're right. There's a bounty of fintech talent in Israel, and I really don't know what that roots back to, but would love to learn more about that.
I wanted to ask you about Jeeves, not the web 1.0 search engine, but the corporate card provider that was founded just last year and went through the Y Combinator accelerator. You also included them. This has obviously been an incredible year for Brex and Ramp and other competitors in the corporate card space. Tell us about Jeeves and why they made the list, given how young they are.
Yeah, I think actually Jeeves is the highest valued company on my list with $500 million valuation. And I think it has to do with the companies that you just mentioned, which are Brex and Ramp, which are also companies that offer corporate cards. These two companies are also young and have very high valuations. Ramp, for instance, I think is nearing about a $4 billion valuation, and that company was founded in 2019. So this is a category that is very overheated, that there is a lot of investor excitement in. And I think that is one reason why you're seeing Jeeves with a valuation that high already. It's just kind of the price for this market. But I think that Jeeves is a really interesting and promising company because it is similar, yes, to Brex and Ramp, which have done well, but it's focusing on global companies, which is unique in that category. And it's allowing companies based all over the world to pay in their local currencies with no fees. So they can use these corporate cards, they can pay in their local currencies. It helps them do international business. And I think just a company focusing initially on a global scale is unique for that category.
Okay, worth noting that's also an Andreessen Horowitz investment. And Andreessen Horowitz showed up more than anyone else in terms of leading rounds in companies on our TI 50 list. Lastly, let's talk about the last two companies on your list, Selfbook and Altruist. Selfbook is not one that I expected to see here as a pick, given its connection to hotel chains in particular. But tell us about that one.
Yeah, I can see why you would have been surprised to see that one pop up. But I think this list could have too easily been a list of 5 or 6 or 7 fintech infrastructure companies. And you know, last year it could have been 10 consumer-facing fintechs, like in the consumer credit space. But I did want to provide a variety because I think the point of this list is to give somewhat of a representation of the market right now. And Selfbook is an interesting company that is helping hotels, you know, enter the 21st century, accept Apple Pay, accept Google Pay, make hotel reservations easier and allow them to make more money out of them. So I think that it's a unique company, and there's a huge need for software like this to kind of bring industries like the hospitality industry into, introduce them to modern fintech tools. So I think it's fascinating, and I'm excited to see where it goes. You know, as far as I know, the company's done very well, very fast, and has already raised capital from Tiger Global, which is another really active investor on our list, just like Andreessen Horowitz.
And then obviously the public market conditions can be a bit choppy these days, but Altruist is one that directly relates to that. Can you tell us about Altruist?
Yeah, so Altruist is developing digital investment software tailored to registered investment advisors, which helps them run their businesses fully online without physical paperwork. So you are probably seeing a theme here, which is that a lot of these companies are just helping certain industries go fully online. You'd think that the RIA business or the hotel business might have already embraced some of this technology, but sometimes there is a gap and there just isn't software that exists that is tailored to those industries. So that is what Altruist is trying to do. Before founding Altruist, the CEO, Jason Wink, spent a decade building a company called Formula Folios, which was an investment research and advisory firm that has recently merged with Brookstone Capital Management. So he has a lot of experience in the space, and I think that you will see a lot more coming from this company soon. It's definitely been under the radar. I don't think a lot of people are familiar, but from what I understand, they've got a lot planned for 2022, and I think we'll be hearing much more soon.
And should be noted, is reliant on payment for order flow.
Yeah, so it has actually several revenue streams. So it's not fully reliant on payment for order flow, but that is a good thing to bring up. But that is something that, you know, regulators are eyeing, and there could be some changes to that. That's something that Robinhood does rely on, and it's a controversial form of revenue.
We discussed valuations a little bit earlier, certainly in enterprise software. I spoke to another colleague of yours, Kevin, about there are going to be plenty of companies that really got ahead of their skis in terms of valuation and will have some very difficult decisions to make in the future because their underlying business maybe has not caught up to the valuation that they've obtained. Of course, the companies on our list don't really fit that category, which is why we pick them, because they are by definition a lot more reasonable in terms of a multiple or valuation that's been set for them. But in the sector itself, are you envisioning, you know, given that there could be even more investment in fintech startups next year than there was this year, and this year was pretty incredible, $87 billion already. Could there be a similar situation where several years down the line, you're just going to have a lot of, you know, richly valued companies that don't really have a way to exit or get out?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat inevitable. I do think that there will be a correction in the market. You know, this is a historically long bull run. And as a result, you're seeing companies achieve, like we've talked about, achieve valuations that are far too high for their age, such as like a 10-month-old company that is already valued at multiple billions, which you're seeing in crypto, which is something I'm sure we'll talk about more next year. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know when it's coming, but I can say that many companies that we talk about today, and hopefully none of the ones we're highlighting here, of course, but many of the companies we talk about in the newsroom today, they will have down rounds, and some of them surely will shut down entirely. But it's difficult to predict when that'll be, and it's difficult to predict which companies, but I think keeping an eye and keeping a skeptical eye is particularly important in this market.
Okay, well, thank you, Kate, for all that. And next up, we're going to have your conversation with, is it Itai or Doron? Which one's the CEO?
Itai.
Okay, well, we'll have your conversation with Itai in just a moment. So thanks for the insight, Kate.
Thanks.
Hi, Itai. Thank you so much for joining us. We're excited to get into the business of Unit with you today.
Thanks for hosting me, Kate.
I think it'd be really great to start with just a description of what Unit is, what kind of business Unit is for the listeners who have never come across the company before.
Sure. So Unit is a banking as a service platform. We help tech companies offer financial services to their customers, which means bank accounts, cards, payments, and lending. We give our clients a set of APIs, dashboards, and UIs that help them take all these products to market in 5 weeks. And we're based out of New York and Tel Aviv and raised $70 million to date from great VCs and angels.
So banking as a service is a term that I have been hearing more and more about lately, and I'd like to get into kind of the history of that. But first, can you tell us a little bit more about your background and what you were doing prior to starting Unit?
Sure. So we're two founders at Unit, Doron and myself. He's my co-founder and CTO. In 2008, we both started a fintech infrastructure company called Leverate, along with two other co-founders. After several pivots, we found product market fit in the brokerage in a box space. The idea was, if you want to start something like Robinhood in UK, Australia, anywhere in the world, you could come to us with a license and we give you a brokerage in a box. So that's all the pieces you need to run the business, from liquidity to risk management to trading platforms. We had an initial team of four clueless founders. We scaled that company organically to 160 employees in 6 offices. And to date, processes more than $200 billion a month in trading volume. That was a wild ride and a very, very formative experience for both of us. Doron was the CTO all along. I was initially leading engineering at that company, then product for 3 years, and then I moved to Hong Kong as CEO Asia Pacific and completed my transition to the dark side of business. We both left the company in 2015, 2016, started ventures independently, and in 2019, 2 years ago, we came back to the drawing board and just knew that we wanted to do something together again, and that's how Unit started.
So you're tossing around terms like fintech infrastructure, brokerage in a box. You've clearly been in the space, you know, a lot longer than many of the newcomers to banking as a service. Can you trace this term banking as a service back to anything in particular? Or what was kind of the birth of this fintech infrastructure banking as a service vertical?
So we saw a trend that made us curious about where the market was going. We think that fintech comes in two main waves, right? One wave started roughly in 2008. We call it FinTech 1.0. And the second wave is what enables banking as a service. And that's the second wave we call FinTech 2.0. The first wave is all about companies like Chime, Lending Club, Robinhood, really defining themselves based on a single product and trying to beat the incumbents and do things better, faster, cheaper. And so you can say that there are some success stories that have come out of this wave. But you can also say that there are hundreds of companies that died because they did not have the economies of scale and the distribution of the banks. So that's the first wave of fintech. I think that's the wave that really made a dent in the world to date. The second wave is what we call FinTech 2.0, and that's really defined by software companies combining their software with financial services, usually in a very vertical way, right? So in a way that speaks to a specific audience. And we think the word that defined old FinTech was product. The word that defines the new FinTech world is audience. So you find companies that do it at scale, like Shopify and Uber, rolling out financial services to decrease friction, increase loyalty, monetize better. And you also see younger companies like Lens, Moves, focusing on a particular segment and really solving a problem set that's unique to that segment and using financial services as a way to give that value. And so the demand to build fintech came almost exclusively from this new wave in the last couple of years. And we have good reasons to believe that this new wave will be more successful than the old one. Now, the reason banking as a service exists is really... let's look at what it meant to build fintech in the last 10 years, even if you wanted to launch something simple. So we can use Uber as an example, right? Let's say Uber wants to take to market a checking account with a simple debit card. What they need to do is navigate three huge challenges as a company. One is they have to find a bank relationship that enables this offering because the regulatory framework in the US is predicated on banks hosting these services. The second thing is that Uber had to write and operationalize 15 to 20 compliance policies that basically forced them to develop opinions on KYC, KYB, AML, complaint management, InfoSec, privacy policy. It's really heavy. They had to write all these policies and hire the people that operationalize them. And the third thing they have to do, which we now take for granted, is they had to build a lot of tech to create something that looks like a modern banking experience. And the cost was bearable for the first generation of fintech companies that we mentioned, the Chimes and the Lending Clubs. But one, a lot of them ended up building the same things. And two, I think we realized that this new generation of builders need a new generation of tools. So we decided to build Unit so that we own all the pain, all the bank relationships, compliance, and tech are built into this one company. And what we expose to clients are APIs, dashboard, and white labeled UIs that help them launch in 5 weeks with two engineers. So that's kind of the definition of banking as a service as we do it. There are other types of solutions to the banking as a service problem that I can talk about.
Right. You're doing the hard part so that they can, you know, they have that all done and they can launch into these other areas and increase their revenues. So you just said a lot and there's a lot to unpack there. You mentioned FinTech 1.0 and FinTech 2.0. Do you have any idea right now what FinTech 3.0 looks like?
I think FinTech 2.0 is the only kind of horizon I can see for now. I think a lot of people may say that crypto is sort of creating a shadow financial system or a parallel financial system with new rules. That could be a valid argument. I just think that there is a 20 to 30 year run ahead of us that really puts a lot of the distribution power of financial products in the hands of software companies. And that's what we're really focusing on.
Is Unit thinking about crypto and what that means for the business right now? Or is that not something that's on the horizon for you guys yet?
So we have a lot of product dilemmas when we think about big areas like crypto and investments, whether we want to make them part of our product or whether we want to allow our clients to stitch together the Unit ecosystem with outside ecosystems. For both investing in crypto, we chose the latter. So we chose to allow our clients to choose the best wallet / liquidity provider for crypto. And if they want to allow people in their ecosystem to hold both dollars and crypto, we hold the dollars, a Coinbase type company holds the crypto, and our client is basically floating these two balances into one user interface. So we chose not to engage in crypto so far because we think it's a deep enough domain that we should leave it for other companies. And we can, of course, leverage and allow those companies to plug into the Unit ecosystem easily.
Well, I want to talk about competition because, as you know, you're not the only company that's going after this segment. And it seems to be becoming more and more popular amongst founders. And there are companies like Stripe that is also competition for embedded finance or banking as a service companies. So how do you think about that? I mean, are there specific things about Unit that distinguish it from some of these early stage competitors?
Yeah, so I think there are two parts to the answer. Part one is not all flavors to solving the problem are similar, right? There are companies like Galileo or Q2 that launched products that they sell to banks, and then they expect banks to continue to do business the old-fashioned way. And that's these are present competitors in the ecosystem, but these are not ones that we think are directly related to Unit. This is the old generation of how to build fintech. I think the platform approach that Unit takes and other companies take is really kind of the set of competitors that I really consider peers. Stripe is one of them. Stripe announced a product called Stripe Treasury a year ago. It hasn't launched yet. And we believe there's enough substance in banking and there's enough deep domain in banking that you need a specialized company to own that and deliver in that space. We tend to think less about competitors. Of course, we're extremely competitor aware, but we like to think about ourselves as customer-obsessed, competitor-aware, right? Which means that there's so much white space, there's so much redesigning of the financial services supply chain to do that we don't think that the right way to think about it is competitors. We think that there is a 99.9% of the market that we're all trying to change. And it's really similar to how we thought about maybe project management tools 5 years ago, right? Everybody asked, how is Trello different from Asana? How is Asana different from Monday? My answer is that all these companies were fighting the same old habits and that all of them succeeded at the end, right? So I think there is a huge market to take. I think 99.9% is still the white space. And I believe that many companies will succeed in that space.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's a huge market. But, you know, you say you need a specialized team or a specialized mm-hmm. company. I think Stripe is like one of those companies that, you know, they have the resources to hire hundreds of people. You know, say they could hire like 10 times as many people as Unit has. So what is your plan as far as, you know, continuing to fund the business? Do you think that you will need to raise, you know, hundreds of millions more in venture capital or what's next for you as far as investor financing?
We try to think about financing from first principles, right? We raised $70 million to date under very healthy terms and we will capitalize ourselves further when we need to. Currently, we have more than 85% of the money in the bank still. We just burned through the seed money that we raised, $3.6 million at the end of 2019. So we actually, you know, we know that the presence of companies like Stripe in the market can really change the dynamics. But I think the tipping point for Unit was our Series B with Accel, the $51 million Series B in May of this year. Of course, there will be further financings. But when and under what terms we are going to be thinking from first principles in. And I think based on traction, I think it's really important to build the right kind of company. And your point about Stripe is well taken. I also think it's really, really hard for companies that have a very scalable business model like Stripe to get into new spaces that are heavily, heavily regulated and have a lot of attention to every client. So the machine that we're building, both from a product point of view, from an organizational point of view, is geared towards supporting hundreds of companies. And it's really not easy, right? From a compliance point of view, from a fraud point of view, from a tech perspective.
And 50 million, 70 million, I mean, that sounds like a lot of money, I think, for people who are, you know, don't spend every day reading headlines about massive valuations of massive rounds. But as you know, in this market, it's a founder's market. And in raising venture capital, you know, for a good company has pretty much never been easier. So you are taking a more disciplined approach to fundraising. What are your thoughts just kind of about the venture capital market right now? I mean, every record's been broken this year. Every company, you know, that was once a $100 million valuation is a $2 billion valuation. I mean, it just seems like there are signs of a bubble. Like, what are your feelings about the market right now?
To be honest, we have no special take on it, and I'll explain. First of all, part of why there are more dollars today in fintech specifically is that the market frenzy. But also part of it is the definition of fintech today is much broader than it used to be, right? The companies you would call fintech is just a lot of companies that are on the spectrum between pure play fintech and not fintech. And so we enable a lot of these companies, and I think the definition has just changed. As I said, we bootstrapped our previous company and we grew to a meaningful size, which really informs our execution. I have no special take on the fundraising frenzy, except we're grateful for it because the amount of capital that's available to innovators today is unprecedented, and many innovators choose to build on Unit. When I say that we have no special take on it, I mean, we're building a company for a 5 to 50 year trend that we have a strong conviction about. We believe there are moats in this business and we're just trying to focus on the customers.
So aside from potentially, you know, raising additional capital in, say, the next year, what else can we expect to see Unit do in the next 12 months?
Yeah, so I think the number of financial products that exist in the world is actually pretty finite, right? We have accounts, cards, payments, and lending today. I think the last bucket, lending, is really what we want to double down on in 2022. I think there is a lot of players today that offer simple checking accounts or cards, but lending is still an untapped part of the market. And that's the part that I think will lead a lot of the tipping points in fintech in the coming years. So we want to make lending and credit products as easy as it is to build deposit accounts and cards today. And that's going to be our focus in 2022. I think you'll see a lot of the market moving there because credit products have a real pull for the end customers. And it's really, really hard and expensive to build them for a whole bunch of reasons we can talk about. But if you put a system in place that lets people build effortlessly, I think it will unlock a lot of new types of companies and will really change the game.
And will that require you to expand the employee base of Unit quite a bit? Or what are the hiring plans for the company?
Yeah, so again, hiring and expanding from first principles. We don't do it in response to investor expectations or market optics. We do it in response to actual things that need to be done in the company, and we're trying to be thoughtful about it. Yes, when we expand to credit, there will be additional headcount on all fronts, right? Engineering front, on the underwriting and compliance front, on the bank relationships front, on the ops front. So it's going to be an undertaking that has many dimensions, almost like every product we touch, but we're ready to do it and we're excited.
So how many employees do you expect to have then end of next year?
however many we need. if our growth plans materialize, it will likely be 150 employees at the end of next year.
Got it. Well, a lot of exciting times ahead, it sounds like. Thanks again for joining us for a quick conversation about Unit, and congrats for your number one spot on our FinTech top startups list.
Thanks for hosting us, Kate.
And coming up next, we'll be talking to Enrique Dubregras, the CEO and co-founder of Brex. Welcome, Enrique.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
So for those listening who may not be familiar with Brex, I thought it would be great to start off with maybe a minute or so of you telling us a little bit about the origin story of Brex.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm originally born and raised in Brazil. So before coming to the US, I actually started a payments company out of high school in Brazil called Pagarmen. That was like a Stripe of Brazil. So we did payment processing for companies down there. And we always thought that the next step, you know, we were building financial services for businesses. We always thought that the next step would be there would be building banking for businesses, but we sold the company before we got to execute on it. And then when we moved to the US, we originally tried a VR idea, virtual reality idea, but quickly pivoted to Brex. And similar to what we wanted to do with our last company of keep building banking and B2B financial services for companies, that's what we did at Brex as well. So we started a corporate card for startup that evolved now to a lot more. We do corporate cards, business accounts, expense management software, bill pay software, venture debt, and a variety of other products that we built over the year for companies.
So how does one get from virtual reality to corporate cards for startups?
Yeah, so honestly, when we got to the US, we were like, we don't want to do fintech again. We're tired of fintech. You know, it's we want to do something on the bleeding edge of technology and something that's like very innovative, the same way Steve Jobs and Bill Gates did something, you know. And I think we quickly realized that we're probably not smart enough to do virtual reality. It's like a really, really, really hard, complicated problem. And we knew a lot about fintech already, so we decided to go back to our roots and do something in fintech. But it was a good 3 months of trying to do VR that kind of was really hard.
Well, I'll get to more Brex-specific questions in a minute here, but I want to ask you just what your thoughts are on the amount of capital that's been invested in fintech. I think, you know, when you got started with Brex 4 years ago, fintech was not as hot as it's become in 2020 and 2021. So did you see that coming? And what do you think of all that capital?
Yeah, you know, I think one of our investors, Ribbit, in their office, if you get in, they have a phrase that I think it resonates super well, which is it takes money to change money. And I think that's probably true. I think actually the amount of capital that's possible to raise now is enabling fintechs to exist. I think it's very much a causation effect, because in order to have the credibility, have the balance sheet to actually compete with banks in a meaningful way and to get to scale, like, it requires a lot of capital. And I think that the few cases of success, you know, of investors investing in fintech, getting a good return, is now enabling a whole new set of capital to be invested, which I think will enable a lot more fintechs to succeed. I think there's a very cause effect there. I think, look, in 2017, when we started, it wasn't super hot, but it was pretty hot, you know. I think, well, at least coming from Brazil, being the U.S. descent, was really hot. But I think it definitely got a lot more recently.
Do you have any concerns that there might be too much capital being invested into some of these businesses?
Not particularly. I think, you know, different than I think a lot of other businesses, if you look about fintech, they're not trying to convince you to buy something that you never needed before. Some businesses do, but most fintech businesses, they're trying to win existing budgets in a more efficient, better way, right? So I think, and the market is massive, right? Like, if you just look at the market cap of banks in the world, is in the trillions of dollars. So I think there's few industries that have so much potential like fintech does. So I think it's hard to overdo fintech, in my view.
All right. These are capital intensive businesses. Brex has raised several hundred million dollars just in 2021. And most recently at a reported valuation of $12.3 billion, just huge. Can you talk a little bit about how you've been investing that capital or what your plans are to invest all of that capital?
Yeah, absolutely. So look, I think historically when I got asked that question, you know, I said, hey, you know, a lot of it is for a rainy day and for, you know, investing. We have a lot of receivables and we need to finance it. But we definitely have had more than enough capital for that for a while now. I think the big thing for us now is really expansion. Is I think with especially as we went remote, the amount of engineers that we get to hire now all over the world just increased a lot, you know. And I think investing in these engineers and in these new, you know, talent for Brex, as well as and the go-to-market organization to grow faster, it's a big part of where investment goes. And in terms of where specifically are these engineers working on, it's, I think, super important for us to keep developing the products that we have, and especially around expense management, bill pay, and the venture debt products, and some of the newer products that we launch, keep developing those and also, you know, making them work for like larger companies as well.
And you mentioned hiring all over the world. Brex very recently, I think, went or became a fully remote company, right? So you're no longer requiring employees to come into any central headquarters. Has that made hiring for Brex much easier than it had been in the past? Or how has that affected your hiring?
Massively easier. Like, I cannot overstate how much easier it got. I think before, one of the big problems with Brex is like, oh, we need to hire, you know, 30 engineers per quarter. Like, oh my God, are we going to hit the goal this month? You know, I don't know. Like, it's, like right now, it's like not even an issue. Like, we could hire more if we wanted to. It's I think that the access to global talent changed so much, the dynamic for us there, that, you know, it's a massive advantage.
And you relocated yourself, right? You left San Francisco, like many other tech executives. How do you feel about kind of the exodus from Silicon Valley? And do you think that it's true that, you know, that area is not what it once was in terms of being the most important tech hub?
I think it'll still be the most important tech hub. It will just not be more than everyone else combined, which was like it was in the past. So I think that if you looked before, like 5-10 years ago, and you got the market cap of tech companies created at that time in San Francisco, it probably was more than all the other ones combined, right? And I think that the market share of San Francisco is definitely decreasing a lot. But if you were to rank, I wouldn't see anywhere else that would be more important than San Francisco. So that being said, if I was a founder today, I would not build a company in San Francisco, you know, if I ever started out again.
Where would you build it?
Probably either New York would probably be my pick. Even though I love LA, I think LA is great. I think it's still earlier. I think New York's a little bit more developed, so I'll probably pick there.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest conversations in startups and tech this year has been kind of these up and coming markets. I mean, New York is not one I'd call up and coming, but it's becoming a much more important hub for especially fintech and crypto. What other trends or surprises in tech, fintech specifically, have you been really interested in this year?
I wasn't a bullish guy on crypto in 2020. And then in 2021, I completely changed. I am extremely bullish on crypto right now. And I think it, for me, I always thought of crypto as crypto will only work when there's like, you know, you can pay with Bitcoin for your coffee. And now I think that that like use case is like not important at all. There's like so many different new use cases, NFTs and DeFi and, you know, the gaming that just are creating new uses for crypto that, you know, we didn't even think before. And those are getting to massive scale. You know, I think I told the story earlier today, but I have two cousins that their full-time job in Brazil is to play Axie Infinity, you know, and they make more money than most of their friends playing Axie Infinity, and it's all in crypto. So I think there's like massive potential there. And I wasn't a believer before. I completely changed my mind.
Right. I mean, a lot of people have had that exact same sort of transformation when it comes to their thinking on crypto in 2021. What does that mean for Brex? What is your bullishness on crypto? Does that impact Brex's trajectory in any way?
Yeah, look, we're looking for, you know, the way for us to play in it, right? I think enterprises and businesses, they are probably 10 years later than consumer. So I don't think we're going to see a lot of, you know, very big enterprise use cases for a while, but in crypto. But one of the things that we did launch that's having like extremely good adoption is our crypto rewards. So the fact that you can use your points and redeem them directly into crypto is it's been a very good way for companies to get some exposure, right? Because I think you see companies like Square or Tesla kind of went back and forth. I don't know what they left, but like kind of like buying crypto on the balance sheet. And some earlier stage startups or companies might not be as aggressive and say, I want to use investor money to buy crypto, right? But your credit card points is probably like a super easy way to start you know, getting some exposure to it.
Have you started building out any crypto teams, hired any crypto engineers, or what steps have you taken in that direction?
Well, we acquired a crypto company in 2018, I think, or 2019, I think, called Elf. You know, there were engineers that were super talented. And I think we hired definitely a bunch of people from crypto companies. So we have a lot of people at Brex that have the knowledge. I think we're still figuring out how strategically it's going to play for us, right?
Was there a specific moment for you that changed your perspective on crypto, or was it just kind of watching the success of Axie Infinity and companies like Dapper?
I think it's when I used Uniswap for the first time. I thought it was quite impressive.
Have you been investing any of your personal capital into crypto companies, or are you looking at other fintechs right now?
I don't invest a lot personally. Just, you know, the reason is I do invest sometimes, and I always tell people it's like my priority is Brex. I don't really have a lot of time to help people whenever they need. I hate to be the investor that's like not super helpful, you know, so a lot of times I prefer not to invest. But crypto, I don't need to help. So I have a bunch of Bitcoin and ETH and stuff like that.
Fair enough. Are there other themes or trends within fintech, crypto aside, that you've been interested in this year?
I definitely have been, I wouldn't say surprised, but excited about the scale that the neobanks are getting. So, you know, if you look at Nubank, for example, I think it's a good example that just filed their F1. And, you know, look, I think 50% of their customers receive their paycheck. And I'm not 100% sure of this data. That's, I think, what I remember. But like 50% of their customers receive their paycheck into Nubank, right? So that is, I don't know, like 20 million Brazilians, like 10% of the country almost, that, you know, they're their primary bank account. That's like massive, massive scale from a neobank. So I think it kind of proves that, you know, fintechs will get like massive market share around the world, not only like, you know, in small use cases.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of neobank public offerings here in the next, you know, in 2022, including Nubank and perhaps Chime. What about Brex? Is there anything, you know, you could share about your plans to take the company public?
So I think different than startups in the previous generation, we actually want to be a public company. You know, it's not something that we're opposed, and we definitely are taking steps in that direction, right? So we were audited by a big four audit firm since the first year of the company, which is, you know, an important requirement to go public, is having 3 years of audited financials. You know, we already have two independent directors in our board. So we're definitely taking the steps. I think that we definitely don't want to go public too early. And because going public too early is bad for everyone, right? So it just causes a lot of volatility in the stock. And then the retail investors are the ones that actually suffer the most when you go public too early, because, you know, they get, a lot of times they get scared, their stock goes down, and then, you know, they sell and they lose money and it goes up again. And it's like, you know, this up and down all the time. Versus, I think, you know, we would want to go public once we think that, you know, the stock would be relatively stable because it's very predictable and all that. So we're, I think, just waiting for our business to get more predictable, you know, and I think it just comes with time, right? We're, at the end of the day, we're 4.5 years old. So I don't think we're super late to the public game, you know, at all. So
would you rule out a 2021 IPO?
Yes.
Oh, sorry, not a 2021 IPO. A 2022 IPO.
I wouldn't rule it out, but I would say it's unlikely.
So what else do you think is in store for fintech in 2022, either for Brex specifically, if there's anything that you could talk about there, or just, you know, what other predictions do you have for some of the other businesses and trends in the category?
Yeah, you know, I think there's something, I forgot who said this, but like there's two ways of making money, like bundling and unbundling, right? So the first wave of fintechs, they start unbundling, which is like, hey, let me get one product from the bank. Let's get corporate cards, right, for Brex, and just do them like super well and grow and get to scale. And then you get to scale, it's like, okay, I have all these customers who love me, love our brand, love the product. What else can we offer them? And then you rebundle it, right? And you start selling them new things as well. So I think a lot of the fintechs were in the unbundling stage for many years and acquiring out this user base. I think 2022 is going to be the year of rebundling for a lot of them, right? And you can start seeing this. So I think we're going to see a lot of fintechs starting to compete that previously didn't compete that much. And, you know, Square Cash competing with Robinhood, competing with Chime, you know, I think there's going to be a lot of new, because all of them are kind of going to build the similar product sets to sell to their customers, each own their own edge and differentiation. And I think that's going to be true. And the hard part about that is that the next generation that is trying to unbundle again, it's harder to unbundle against the tech company a little bit more, you know? So, you know, if there's there's five apps doing stock trading and checking accounts and cards, and it's going to be hard for a new entrant to come and just do one of them and do super well. So I think that it will close the market for a lot of new fintechs as well. It's kind of going to become like how Facebook and Google and consumer world, you rarely see new consumer tech because, you know, you have Facebook, Google, Amazon. They do everything that's working consumer, they kind of do, and it works, and you very rarely see something work. I think with fintechs, it's going to have some effect that there's some window that you can create a new kind of like consumer fintech that has a chance of working, and then as these companies get to massive scale, I think that window is going to start to close down.
And all of that means more competition for Brex too, right?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I would definitely put us in the position of, you know, we're definitely in the rebundling stage in which we're building more products, launching more products. And, you know, I think it's going to be harder for new fintechs to come and compete with us and a lot of our products, just because we already have the customer, the brand and the acquisition and all that. So,
well, I'll stop there. Thank you for joining us, and we really appreciate having you back. And hopefully we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The Information's 411, and thanks to Kate Clark, Itai Domti, and Enrique Dubagras for participating in the episode. This episode was produced by Spoke Media. From Spoke, producer Cody Hoffmachl, coordinating producer Alicia Force, mixing and mastering engineer Will Short, associate producer Lucy Wong, and executive producer Keith Reynolds. From The Information, Anne Marinovich and Becky Eventash, I'm Amir Efradi. Have a great weekend, everyone.